connecting sleep to sports isn't easy, but here goes. Mattress Firm is America's neighborhood mattress store, and it should be your goal to check out the deals they have going on every day. Their mattresses are softer than your rival team's defense. They get a 10 out of 10. You'll love your new bed. Okay, all terrible dad jokes aside, head to mattressfirm.com/podcast and stretch your budget further than a gymnast before a floor routine. The Colts finally got their guy. We're breaking down the Frank Reich, Andrew Luck marriage. Plus, A.J. McCarron is a free man and what that means for the quarterback market. Larry Fitzgerald is coming back. And listener questions on Jimmy Garoppolo's flaws, Jacoby Brissett's potential future in Baltimore, and that bizarre Malcolm Butler benching. It's all on the MMQB 10 Things podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. I'm Gary Gramling. He is Annie Benoit. We are not quite in the free agency phase of our offseason here, so we're going to do a little bit of a, let's call it a potpourri type of show here, the old Jeopardy category, potpourri. I don't know if they still do that, but we're going to have a little bit of everything, and we're going to finish it up with a mailbag today. We got coaches to talk about, a couple player news things to talk about. Yeah, kind of a grab bag here, Andy.
Love it. Let's get right into it then. You said we have mailbag at the end, right?
Mailbag at the end, yeah. We'll like I said, I think most of the shows this offseason we'll finish with a mailbag, unless we're really overwhelmed with what our lead subject is. But I guess I have to open this with an apology, Andy, because we talked about this Super Bowl night. We talked about Josh McDaniels and the possibility that Josh McDaniels might not take the Colts job, and you were very open to that possibility. You seem to have a gut feeling that it might actually happen, and I laughed at you, and then I said, off the air, I said unforgivable things behind your back to anyone I could find. I woke up my family and made fun of you, and lo and behold, Josh McDaniels is out. Frank Reich is in. Let's start with the Frank Reich aspect of this. Let's start positive. That Reich-Andrew Luck marriage, that seems like it would be a good thing.
Yeah, I think so, because what Frank Reich was probably able to do is walk into Chris Ballard's office and Jim Irsay's office, Chris Ballard, the Colts GM, Jim Irsay, the owner, of course, and say to them, hey, that quarterback you have there, let's assume he's healthy, I've coached the only other quarterback in the NFL who is similar to him stylistically, and look what we did with him. I mean, we made him the MVP of the league before he got hurt. I'm the guy that can help you with Andrew Luck. And Frank Reich has done things for quarterbacks, a variety of different kinds of quarterbacks with a variety of different kinds of systems. And that's important because with Andrew Luck, you can run almost anything, and it's going to work well as long as you have some continuity with it and you're building around it and letting everybody else grow around him. So that's got to be his sales pitch to them, is I've worked with the other version of Andrew Luck and Carson Wentz, a younger version who has arguably been even better than Luck has ever been at some point. So who else would you hire that could say that in the NFL? I don't know if there's anybody else out there who is a candidate where they could have said what he said like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, I'm excited. Frank Reich's been a favorite of mine. That, we'll see how it goes. Sometimes great coordinators are not great head coaches. We'll see how it plays out. But I think going back to the work he did in San Diego with Philip Rivers, a lot of things to feel good about here if you're a Colts fan. The McDaniels thing, I'm still just floored by it. Because the obvious parallel was obviously, you know, Belichick and the Jets back in the day, and it was kind of like, oh, that's not going to happen again. That's too on the nose. That's lazy fiction writing at this point. But it happened, and I mean, he hasn't gotten a guarantee by all reports that he'll be the heir apparent to Belichick, but presumably he will be the heir apparent to Belichick when Belichick decides to hang it up.
Isn't it kind of ironic? Belichick's the last coach that was entangled in something sort of like this when he was working for Bill Parcells, and it happened in a few different directions with Belichick and Parcells, and it was not smooth. So I don't know what that means for McDaniels. Maybe they feel he is the heir apparent now. A lot can happen between now and whenever the future is, or the change in the future. So I don't know how much stock I put into that. Gary, has it surprised you? One thing we've kind of heard floated around is Well, the Patriots have a really stable owner in Bob Kraft, and the Colts with Jim Irsay do not have a stable owner. And I understand why people would say that. To me, Irsay has never been unstable as an owner, though. He's had some unstable parts of his life, and he'll tweet some weird stuff in the middle of the night, which can get you elected president anymore anyway, so I don't know what the big deal with that would be. He's never run the team with an instability, though. The Colts have never been a dysfunctional franchise at all, and he's always been very patient with coaches, very patient with long-term process. I think he's been a good owner, at least by what we all kind of agree. If you're a coach, you want in an owner, which is hands-off and patience.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, look, if anything, his biggest mistake over the last few years, and again, we're setting aside his personal life, but his biggest mistake as far as running the team was probably sticking with Gregson for too long, and I like Chuck Pagano. I think they could have found a way to make it work with Chuck Pagano if they had the right players. They didn't have the right players, and that's a whole other discussion. I don't think Pagano's great, but I think Pagano was good enough.
I agree with you.
Yeah, it's... It was just, again, look, Josh McDaniels gets to do what he wants to do. It was certainly off-putting and bizarre, and I don't know. I don't know where the Patriots stand in this too. I don't know when it reaches a point where it's kind of like, your guy is gone. You have to give up at some point, but. Obviously, they still had an opening, and they used it to retain their offensive coordinator. So,
the one thing I wish they wouldn't do, and I understand why they've done it, and it's over now. They only had to do it in the press conference. But when they sat up there and said, like, "Well, we were such idiots. Why didn't we see Reich in the first place? I've been kicking myself anyway, and here we got him." That to me sounds like BS, and. Just get up there and say, yeah, it's true. We didn't give Frank Reich probably enough consideration in our first round of the head coaching search. And yes, we chose Josh McDaniels over him. Since we made that decision, though, Reich's offense has gone on to outscore McDaniels' offense in the biggest stage. And Reich's offense did it with a backup QB. And we're glad to go take a closer look at him. And we're glad he's the guy. And just leave it at that. And rather than this whole, oh, I'm kicking myself. Why? We were dumb back there. They weren't dumb back there. I'm sure they did a thorough search. Everybody does a pretty thorough search. It probably could have been more thorough. But I think you need to own that Frank Reich wasn't your first choice. Nobody's going to remember that or care if they go 5-1 to start the season, and just move along. But that's not a big deal either. I mean, this is just the kind of stuff you think about in the off season when you're waiting for real news to happen.
Exactly, and I had Jacob Feldman, who writes the MMQB newsletter for us, which you should all subscribe to if you don't already. The Morning Huddle. We had talked about this. I had him research this. The team that made the last coaching hire of each basically coaching cycle and how it played out. And the last coaching hires, these are all teams that got passed up by their first choice, or in some cases, first two choices. But it's Kyle Shanahan out in San Francisco, Dan Quinn in Atlanta, Bruce Arians in Arizona, and Doug Peterson in Philly. So... we play. Those are four of the last five. The other one in that group is Mike Pettine. So you can do with that what you will. You sort of run the whole the whole spectrum there. But yeah, we kind of play this up, this sort of horse race aspect to it, and like, oh, they didn't get their first choice, so now they're settling type of thing. It's just there's so many variables that go into whether a guy's going to be successful or not. It's almost like you're all picking like a random number out of a hat or something, and you just hope you end up getting the right match. But yeah, I
wonder
think
how
Colts
many
fan, you,
how many
you feel good about it.
Yeah, I wonder how many teams get their first choice when they're drafting a guy or hiring a head coach. I bet it's like in the 30 percentile. Getting your first choice in the NFL, that's not easy to do. And I wouldn't worry. Yeah, I think that's a great stat or a great tidbit too. Those last four, those last five coaches, what they went on to do.
It's a league. Hey, the best quarterback of all time was a six rounder who was a backup. So weird things happen when you don't get your first choice. Moving on, a little more coaching news here. A couple of coordinators that we've been talking about throughout the last couple weeks. Let's start with John DeFilippo getting the job in Minnesota. He will replace Pat Shurmur. He's got a lot to live up to. He was, DeFilippo was basically at the top of most lists. I mean, he was getting some head coaching buzz. So for the Vikings to be able to land him is impressive. But he's got a lot to live up to with Pat Shurmur moving on.
Yeah, he does, but this is a good opportunity for all parties involved. DeFilippo, you just said what a hot candidate he was, and then from his perspective, Mike Zimmer's going to run the defense, and DeFilippo's basically going to be the unofficial head coach of the offense. That's usually how that plays out when you have a head coach who's so clearly invested in one side of the ball. And remember, Mike Zimmer calls the plays defensively, so he's essentially acting as the defensive coordinator, which is all the more indication that DeFilippo is going to just run the offense with almost, I would guess, almost autonomy. The other thing that I think is worth noting is the Vikings did not let Kevin Stefanski, their quarterback coach, follow Pat Shurmur to New York. And Shurmur wanted Stefanski as the offensive coordinator, and the Vikings had interviewed Stefanski as OC, and we talked about maybe that's a possibility. You and I had talked about that, Gary. And I think for Stefanski's a tremendous young coach. He's coached a lot of different positions. I kind of thought the Vikings, given where they are with everything, and given that whoever the coordinator on offense is, that guy's basically going to be the unofficial offensive head coach. I'm not surprised they wanted to go with someone who's a little bit more experienced and someone who's done it before and has run an offense before. And remember, DeFilippo did when he was working for Mike Pettine with the Browns. So I understand why Minnesota didn't want to risk a coach who hasn't been a coordinator before and hasn't been a play caller before. But the fact that they wouldn't let Stefanski leave, and he's been there a long time with a lot of different regimes now in Minnesota, that to me suggests they think DeFilippo might be a one and done, and they could see him leaving as a head coaching candidate somewhere next year, and then they've got their in-house guy already and Stefanski built in. So I don't think this whole thing is done. I don't think DeFilippo's viewed as the long-term guy there just because of where his trajectory's headed. But you don't need that. You've got your window now. This is the time to go win the Super Bowl. You're certainly at the top of contention, so you think about only 2018 and you figure out 2019 when that arrives.
Yeah, and you know, with Stefanski, it's a little bit similar to what played out last year in Atlanta, and this is who we're talking about next year. Matt LaFleur, who of course is the quarterback's coach with the Falcons in 2016, Kyle Shanahan moves on, and LaFleur doesn't get the job. Dan Quinn opted to bring in Steve Sarkisian, who had the experience running a team, running a locker room. And that's really what sort of led Quinn to go in that direction. LaFleur, of course, goes out, joins L.A., goes out, joins Sean McVay's staff as offensive coordinator. And now he has been poached by the Titans. He will be the offensive coordinator there. We had talked about this job. The Titans had been heavily linked to Ryan Day, who is at Ohio State. He has a lot of connections to the Chip Kelly and Marcus Mariota stuff going back to Oregon. But yeah, they end up getting LaFleur, who I guess you'd call a little bit more of a traditional NFL coordinator as opposed to Day, who might have brought some more of a college feel to this offense. But we both like LaFleur. It's an interesting spot here with Marcus Mariota and where he is in his development and what LaFleur can do with him.
Yeah, it is. It's a very interesting spot, because whoever they hired there in Tennessee was going to be someone that was willing to play to Mariota's style. My guess, and I do not know this, but my guess is that's why Mike Mularkey was not retained, because Mularkey really doesn't play to Mariota's unique skill set. He plugs Mariota into his system and works around it. And that's my guess is that's not what the bosses in Tennessee wanted, the big bosses. So they wanted Day. I'm sure they thought they had him. I'm sure Vrabel thought he had him. They didn't get him. Now you've got to pivot, make a change of direction. I don't think Vrabel knew LaFleur very well, if at all, which suggests that he got some help from the front office. But LaFleur, I think, was a candidate for the Titans job as well, the head coaching job.
Yep.
So someone in that organization was familiar with him. And they said, Mike, you're the defensive guy. Well, let's go find someone who can be the offensive head coach, so to speak, to a limited degree. And how about that guy that we interviewed for the head coaching job who we kind of liked? And that's LaFleur. Now, your point about him and Mariota and that marriage there is a fascinating one, because LaFleur has not worked with that kind of QB before. He had Matt Ryan, who's the kind of QB every coach wants. He's just a very traditional, athletic enough, certainly smart enough, good enough arm, and all those enoughs make a very good NFL quarterback. That's what you want as a coach. He's had that, and then he had Jared Goff, who's also a kind of a traditional type of pocket passer. And LaFleur believes strongly in the value of pocket passing. He thinks the three things you need at QB are is a natural throwing ability, and we could debate whether Mariota has that. He needs some mechanical work. And then a willingness to stay in the pocket. I think Mariota has shown that early in his career. He hasn't been quite as good as he's had some issues. You know, maybe it's injuries. Maybe it's just some failures here that come with being a pro. He hasn't been quite as great in that sense lately. And then intangibles, and that's up to anyone's guess of who's got that and how. But that's how he views football. And so they're hiring a guy who views football from a traditional pocket passing standpoint, but they've got a guy who they don't in Tennessee probably feel is a traditional pocket passer. He's a college-style QB. Let's play to that. And it'll be interesting to see what wins out and how. And I would imagine LaFleur will try to bend Mariota to what those powers around him want him to be. But if Mariota's got mechanical glitches, which he does, that's hard to work around. And that has to either be corrected or hidden. And that's going to be LaFleur's big first challenge.
Yeah.
He loves the mechanics of quarterbacking, too. He will go into immense detail about it. So maybe that's also a factor. Is LaFleur said, hey, I know how we can fix Mariota. Let me explain it to you. And that's what got him the job.
Yeah, exactly. He must have said something that, that the front office really liked when he had that head coaching interview. And certainly he has the background to work up Mariota into what they want him to be as an organization. More quarterback news here. We are going to, by the way, we will have free agent special shows the next two shows. Next week is going to be, we're going to do free agent quarterbacks only. We're going to break all of them down. And then the week after that, we will do basically everyone else in the class. Not literally everyone else, but we will talk about the guys we want to talk about in the rest of the free agent class there. So look forward to that. One of the guys who is now going to be discussed on next week's show, that's going to be A.J. McCarron, who was granted unrestricted free agency. There was a, you know, it was up in the air because he was injured. He was on the non-football injury list, I believe, his rookie year. And it was a question of whether that year would toll or not. But he has been granted unrestricted free agency, so he could sign everywhere, anywhere at this point. He's a guy who has buzz around him because of the Browns trade, because he saw a bunch of starts late in the season the last time the Bengals went to the playoffs. I think we're both kind of in the same boat in that we don't quite get what the appeal is, Andy?
Yeah, and look, I'm not saying McCarron can't play. Maybe he can. And you pointed out Tom Brady, everybody says this, but he was a low-round draft pick, and he wasn't the guy people realized. So you never know with these quarterbacks. But why is McCarron right now being billed as this highly coveted QB? Because when you look at McCarron, what you see is a guy who was drafted in the fifth round and who backed up what has been the most wildly average quarterback I probably have ever seen in my life, and Andy Dalton. And even after that mini playoff run, which, by the way, didn't amount to anything, McCarron still remained Dalton's backup. So the people who've been around him, who know McCarron best, have kept him on the bench behind Andy Dalton, who that coaching staff, I can tell you privately, they don't love him. They love him personally, but they know what he is. And so I don't, for the life of me, begin to understand how is McCarron being talked about as a guy who's going to have options and he's going to get to go where he wants. And that can't possibly be true. There's no evidence that why would he be that?
I don't know, Andy. I just don't know. When I look at him, I could see him getting in. And everyone laughs at Mike Glennon now. Oh, my God. They gave Mike Glennon $45 million. I mean, Mike Glennon got a one-year contract. Setting aside the amount of cash he was paid out, and the Bears have that money to pay people, Mike Glennon just came in and you know, he was briefly a bridge guy, and then they moved on. I mean, that's the way it goes. That's really not there was nothing problematic with the Glennon signing. They got their quarterback in Chicago now. They just brought in two and said, you know, one of them, let's see. So I could see, especially, I mean, look, Cleveland is obviously the team he'll be linked to because they tried to trade for him last year. They tried to give up a second-round pick for him last year.
And by the way, people can say, well, Hugh Jackson does know him. He coached him, and he wanted him. And that's the counter-argument to what I just said, or what you and I are saying here. And I hear that, but continue on, because I don't think that means anything, quite frankly. I don't think that changes what McCarron is. He was still the backup to Andy Dalton for a number of years. Hugh Jackson didn't replace Dalton with him either. He had to when Dalton was hurt for a little bit.
I think it would be logical for the Browns to, assuming, and look, maybe there will be a bidding war. We saw with Brock Osweiler 2 years ago. All it takes is two teams to make a bidding war. But if there's not a bidding war for McCarron, I think it makes sense for Cleveland to bring him in on a similar deal to what Glennon got in Chicago, where it's basically a one-year deal with two team options after that. Bring him in. The quarterbacks are good in this draft, but I think outside of Josh Rosen, I don't know if there's anyone you'd look at and say, I am comfortable dropping this guy into my lineup week one. Any of them could become that. There are also, I mean, there are a couple guys in Josh Allen and Lamar Jackson who are spectacular talents, but, you know, are sort of raw guys to work with at this point. So you might need a bridge guy, and it might just be like Glennon. It might be a bridge guy who just lasts a month or two. And I guess McCarron could fit that mold. I mean, he knows Hugh Jackson's offense, so you could drop him right in there.
And McCarron, because here's the other thing that baffles me that people have been saying is, well, McCarron wants to go somewhere where he can play. He doesn't want to be the next Mike Glennon. He wants to go somewhere where he can play and be the long-term answer. If that's true, that's stupid. He ought to be wanting to be the next Mike Glennon, because it's entirely possible McCarron can't play. Again, he was a fifth-round pick, and he hasn't really played much in the NFL. So if you can go out and get Mike Glennon money, and he's only had rookie contract money in his career, McCarron has. He hasn't ever had a big contract. If someone can go give you, what, around $18, $20 million, whatever it is that Glennon got, if you can get that just on the idea of your potential for 1 year, go do that. And if you can play, you'll find your way onto the field. But A.J. McCarron should absolutely be going after wherever he gets the most money, because there is certainly no guarantee he'll get another chance at that.
Yeah, and it's, you know, we talk about the shortage of quarterbacks a lot, and, you know, there's 32 teams or the 32, you know, starting caliber quarterbacks in the world right now. Maybe not, but, I mean, look, plenty of guys on the market here, and on top of that, there are probably five guys who are going to go first round in the draft. So you're going to have these spots taken up. There's not really the desperate need. Like, I don't think there's a lot of teams who are going to settle on a guy who they think is not a potential number one this offseason. And I don't know if anyone sees McCarron that way.
I'd be surprised if they do. And the other, let's remember, it's also unusual that this season has two what appear to be quality starting quarterbacks on the market in Case Keenum and Kirk Cousins. And that says nothing for all the other retread guys who have been finding their ways into lineups for many years. Jay Cutler, Josh McCown especially, guys like that. I mean, if I'm Denver, for example, let's say I can't get Cousins, but I think I'm a quarterback away from serious contention in the AFC West and maybe more, and I'm sure that's how Denver views themselves because of their defense, I'm going for Josh McCown before I'm going for A.J. McCarron. I want to ride the horse I know rather than the one I'm hoping can get around the track.
Yeah, and we have some good player news here. Very good news. Larry Fitzgerald returning for 2018. Reports already told new head coach Steve Wilks he will be playing next year, which is kind of a pleasant surprise because, you know, we all wondered Carson Palmer's gone, new coaching staff coming in. It looks like they're restocking a little bit in Arizona, maybe you would say rebuilding, and would Fitzgerald want to be a part of that? And apparently he is going to come back. You wonder if maybe they have suggested to him that they are going to chase one of these veterans, if not Cousins, maybe a Case Keenum type who can plug in immediately for this team. But Larry Fitzgerald's back and he can play, and that's good.
Well, even if they go out and get Case Keenum, they have a number of other free agents they have to deal with. Fitzgerald's basically the only wide receiver returning. Isn't Jerron Brown and John Brown, aren't they both free agents? Yeah.
Yep.
So they're not probably not going to be able to retain both. They might not retain either. So even if no matter who you get on offense, and I know you do have David Johnson coming back, and that's who you build the offense around, and that's a plus, and he had a wrist injury, so it's not like he hasn't been able to train the last few years. His legs are still good. He'll be ready to go right away. I get that. It's a decent offense, but there's a lot that has to be put in place still for this to work. So I would imagine Fitzgerald's decision came down to just, hey, I still love football. It's still good money. Why not? He's had a great, healthy career, which not a lot of guys have. I'm happy to see it, though. He's still a high – I mean, I thought about him for All-Pro last year. He's still a very high-level player. You know what I think it is in part, Gary? These guys, these slower guys like Hines Ward, Tony Gonzalez for a lot of years, Jason Witten now, the slow guys age very well in football if they're receivers because their game has always been predicated on something other than speed and quickness. So when they lose their speed and quickness, they've got they don't lose their game. And the defense, even if you're slow, the defense still has to play at your speed. They're reacting to you. So if you know how to win without speed, you can play a long time in the NFL because you're still in command. If you're an offensive guy, if you lose your speed on defense, you're done. But these receivers that know how to play without speed, they can last a long time, and Fitzgerald's another reminder of that.
Yeah, that's why I like that Alshon Jeffrey deal that the Eagles signed last
Love the Jeffrey season. Deal, yeah. No, you're right, that's another good example, though. He's not as refined, not even close to refined as Fitzgerald. He's a contested catch guy, but that'll be another interesting one to see is DeAndre Hopkins, Alshon Jeffrey, these guys who also aren't fast but are not refined either. They just are great at catching the ball. How will they age? And we won't know that for a few years because they're in their prime right now. But that'll be an interesting one to watch.
Yeah. And some terrible off-the-field news here. Reuben Foster got in some trouble. Domestic violence is the charge. I mean, look, it's unacceptable behavior, whether you're a professional football player or not. I know a lot of people were pulling for Foster. He had a very difficult upbringing out in Alabama, but, you know, this is something you can't do. He had already had a marijuana arrest during the offseason, and he was already in the program for a diluted sample. So he is looking at a suspension and possibly a lengthy suspension. We'll set aside the off-field discussion for now and just talk about on the field. I mean, he was a guy for the 49ers who looked like he was going to be one of the cornerstones of this young defense, and they might have to be preparing for life without him at this point.
He's 1 year into his career, and so far he's been exactly what everybody thought he would be coming out, and this was the discussion. It's tremendous on-field talent, guy that jumps off the screen, and you've seen that. His burst, his closing speed, all that. He looks different out there, even in the NFL. He certainly looked different in college. So he's been that. But there's also been durability concerns that have kept him off the field. And then obviously these off-field concerns, and we don't know what all happened there, but it's a conversation around him, and that in and of itself is disruptive to the Niners. So Reuben Foster, you've gotten exactly what was advertised so far, and that's what you work with the Niners, and now you're not even in the driver's seat because someone else will be deciding his status, at least entering the 2018 season, and the Niners hopefully are emotionally or mentally prepared for that because there's no reason they shouldn't have been.
Yeah, they had paired him with D'Amico Ryans there on the staff to sort of be a mentor for him, and you know, this is disappointing on so many levels at this point. So back to Mattress Firm. Let's keep the ball rolling, shall we? Everyone knows how important stretching is before an event. So does Mattress Firm. Except it's your dollar. Your budget stretches further when you're shopping at America's Neighborhood Mattress Store. It's a true home run, and you'll have a ball. They're the head coaches when it comes to mattress expertise. But know this, they are more than mattress experts. They have a game plan that helps you transform your mattress into a bed. From adjustable bases and sheets to headboards and bedroom decor, they have you literally and figuratively covered up like your favorite cornerback. Go to mattressfirm.com/podcast to see what deals are happening as I read this sentence to you. They even offer you a 120-night sleep trial to ensure perfection and a 120-night low price guarantee so you know you paid the perfect price. Talk about a 1-2 punch, a knockout, if you will. Score big with a perfect bed. Head to mattressfirm.com/podcast to get the play-by-play on how you can monumentally improve your sleep today, tonight, and tomorrow. All right, Andy, let's do it. Let's open the mailbag. Quick note before we move on. As I said earlier, we're going to have the free agent shows coming up. Free agent quarterbacks next week. Free agent everyone else the week after that. And right now we're gonna go into mailbag. If you want to send questions, we will do these frequently during the off season. You can send to talkback@themqb.com. If you put podcast somewhere in the subject line, it makes it much more visible. Or you can tweet us @ggramling_si, @Andy_Benoit, or we're both on Facebook if you want to get us there. First one. Paul, via TalkBack, should we worry about what we saw from Jimmy Garoppolo in 2017, that it was a bit of a flash in the pan, that NFL defenses will find his weaknesses over the offseason? Have you, I'll pose that to you, Andy, have you noticed anything in his game? I do not have an opinion either way, but are interested in your take. What do you think, Andy? Did you see anything that would maybe be a red flag in Garoppolo's game right now?
Well, first off, I give the disclaimer. I did not read the mailbag questions ahead of time this week. So if we get a stupid one, I'm just going to have to say it's stupid. You know how I tell you beforehand, these are dumb. Now this is not a stupid. This is a very good question. But I'm just giving the disclaimer because I know we have six more of these, and if one of them sucks, I'm going to just say it. Is that all right?
That's part of the drama here.
Okay, but I love this question because I think there is one thing that we need to take into consideration with Garoppolo, and I think he will be a tremendous player. I think he fits the system very well. I love that he's quick in a lot of ways mentally, and then he's got a quick release. There's a twitchiness to him. I like that kind of quarterback, and he's very good at moving within the pocket, very good, natural. Mm-hmm. The one concern you have is he was not as consistently accurate last season as you'd like. And there were some throws that he flat out missed, and that needs to be corrected. And I don't believe you can teach accuracy in the NFL, not by the time guys get that far in their careers and they've been throwing a certain way. But I do think you can polish accuracy and hone it and tidy it up. And with Garoppolo, that's all that needs to be done. Can he polish and tidy up? Now, what we don't know is when conditions around him get choppy, what happens to his accuracy then? Because he probably doesn't get more accurate. So how is he under tribulation, and what does that mean for the way he throws the ball? That's the only concern you have, is he needs to be a little bit more consistent as a down-to-down thrower of the ball, and he needs to do it soon because it's not going to be as – it wasn't easy last year, but it's not going to be smooth sailing like he got for much of the end of last season.
Yeah. Yeah, and kind of the bigger point, I just wanted to make this point to Paul's question here, and I'm going to probably mention this a couple times when we're talking about the draft and the quarterbacks in the draft as we go through the offseason, but Albert Breer had done a piece on Sam Darnold that I worked on with him back in, it was probably October, November, or something like that. Sam Darnold, the USC quarterback, he was the favorite to go number one overall. He still might be the favorite to go number one overall, but he had a couple rocky patches this season, and what a lot of people were talking about with Darnold, and they sort of drew it back to Deshaun Watson last season. Everyone was kind of down on Deshaun Watson because of what he did his junior year, and people were kind of saying, you know, what happened with Watson as a junior was it was his second full season as a starter. Every defensive coordinator took something away from him that he liked to do, and he had to figure out on the fly how to adjust to that, and that's difficult for a young quarterback, and that's why you saw some struggles from Watson at times his junior year, which was his last year at Clemson. Darnold might have gone through something similar this year. This was his first full year as a starter. He had taken over early in his redshirt freshman year, but you know, they take things away from you, and there might be some growing pains when you're trying to adjust to that, especially when you're talking about young quarterbacks. So just something to keep in mind when you're assessing the young guys here. Next question is from Andrew via TalkBack. On the enigma of the Malcolm Butler benching in the Super Bowl, let's take the head coach at his word. what does the film say about the Patriots' defensive strategy during the game? Did they do something different with their defensive backs that didn't fit Butler's skill set? So, yeah, basically, you know, the Patriots said this was a football decision and so on and so forth. So if we are to, let's say, suspend disbelief and say, okay, this was a football decision, did you see anything, Andy, that would have made you say, okay, yeah, this wasn't an ideal situation for Malcolm Butler and what he does well?
No, I didn't, because they played a lot of man coverage in the game, which I think everyone expected, and certainly the Eagles expected. And Malcolm Butler is one of their best man coverage guys, either their first or second best against wide receivers, depending on how you feel about Stephon Gilmore. I've talked to multiple coaches, including Eagles coaches, and not just the ones I talked to right after the game, but others, about, hey, what do you have any idea at all what this was about? And to a man, every one of them has said, we have no idea, and it was ludicrous that he wasn't out there. I mean, the Eagles were overjoyed and couldn't believe their good fortune because of how bad the domino effect was for New England. With Butler gone, that meant Eric Rowe played outside. Eric Rowe was not very good outside, or at least the Eagles felt they knew what he was not good at, and they exploited that. That meant Patrick Chung was now in the slot, because that's where Rowe had typically been playing. Chung got beat a couple of times on fade balls. He actually held up okay the rest of the game. I would have thought Aguilar would have gotten him more than he did, but watching the film, Chung was not awful, but he got beat on two types of throws, outside fade throws that were throws that would not have been there if that had been Eric Rowe and his long arms in the slot. And then because Chung was in the slot, you had Jordan Richards on the field as the sixth defensive back in dime. He's normally the seventh defensive back. He got eaten alive twice in man coverage in the first half as the sixth DB. Zach Ertz got him on the third and seven for 19 yards, and then Corey Clement got him on that long 55 yards on that backfield route. That's at least six or seven plays that directly stemmed from Malcolm Butler's absence. And if you, and I don't like the whole, I'm not usually, I don't believe in what I'm about to say, but you know what I'm getting at? If you take those six or seven plays out of the game, I'm having a hard time seeing how the outcome doesn't change somewhere. I don't think Philadelphia scores 41 points without those six or seven huge first half play. Most of them were in the first half. That was an enormous factor in the game, and if somebody wanted to say the Patriots probably win the Super Bowl, Butler's in there. I'm not quite willing to do that, but I would not argue with that the way I normally would with that kind of butterfly effect sort of statement.
Yeah. Yeah, Albert Breer did some digging for us, and the headline was something about how Robert Kraft didn't even know about the benching until the first quarter was halfway over. But yeah, I mean, there are rumors out there, but the football reasons thing just doesn't add up. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to confirm anything, and it seems like no one else has been able to either.
Which is amazing if you think about it, because he's leaving. I mean, there's no way he'll be back now. Why would he want to return? He's a free agent. You would, and the Patriots are getting killed for this. You would think somebody somewhere would leak it now, because what are you defending with Malcolm Butler? He's not even one of you guys anymore, and he's mad at you. And so, yeah, I've never seen something quite this bizarre. And maybe it is football. I mean, it's so bizarre that you'd think if it's not football reasons, we would have heard something by now, because nobody has any reason not to leak it. So maybe it was football reasons, but I watched every Patriot snap this year. Malcolm Butler's not flawless, but he's a top 20, top 25 NFL corner, and he's certainly one of their two best corners, and they needed him in that game.
Well, yeah, you know, I think the most simple way to put it is Eric Rowe's at least a different style of player. I wouldn't say Eric Rowe is better than Malcolm Butler, but you could say he's a different style, and maybe like the matchup on certain guys with Eric Rowe. But once Johnson Badamosi is on the field, I mean, that makes no sense. There's no conceivable argument that Johnson Badamosi is giving you a better chance to win than Malcolm Butler. So,
and remember, Philadelphia, they don't have great wide receivers. Torrey Smith is not someone you need to change your playing style to handle. Butler would have handled Torrey Smith just fine. Torrey Smith is stiff. He's unreliable. He's very limited as a route runner. And as long as you feel you've got a guy who can run north and south with him, you should feel good going into that matchup. And Butler is a fine downfield on-ball defender. So that's the other part I don't get is, is why did they feel, if it was football reasons, why did they feel they needed to make a huge, and this was a huge adjustment to account for Torrey Smith? The other thing we don't get is why didn't Stephon Gilmore travel with Alshon Jeffrey in the first half? That's the other part that gets lost in all this. And Gilmore did a solid job, a nice job on Jeffrey in the second half, but the Eagles were also surprised about that. New England and the way they used their entire secondary in the Super Bowl, it was baffling. I don't have an explanation for it.
Yep. All right, next question. This is Ryan via Facebook. There have been a number of games over the last few years where an overmatched backup offensive tackle basically costs his team the game. I get that backups just don't have the reps and experience to learn the position like they did, say, 5 or 10 years ago, but why aren't offenses changing personnel and adjusting the play calling to help them out more? Is it too hard to adjust the current schemes in a week or during a game?
These are smart questions. I love our listener questions. They're better than what you and I come up with, Gary. So we need just mailbag everything. it's so much easier on us too. The answer is it doesn't matter if it's hard or not, because if you got a left tackle, and it's usually the left, it's the right tackle as well, I guess. If you have an offensive tackle who cannot win or cannot survive one-on-one, then your offense gets short-circuited, and a lot of the stuff you just simply can't play. So whether it's hard or a big adjustment's irrelevant, because the alternative is nothing at all for your offense, or turnovers even worse. So, and it's not that hard either. There are adjustments. Dallas made some of those adjustments after they learned the hard way that you can't just keep doing whatever you want, even if it's only Adrian Claiborne that you're blocking with a left tackle, a backup left tackle. So you can do chip blocks, you get the ball out quicker, change of formationing, even just something as simple as aligning the tight end on the side of the tackle who needs help. And maybe the tight end doesn't even help, but he's over there, and that, in the very least, it forces the defensive end to line up a little bit wider, so he now has to cover more ground, and it's harder to get to the QB. And there's things you can do to help your tackles. That's just football strategy 101.
Yeah, I mean, the only team I can really remember having to undergo a serious, just complete facelift with their offense midway through the season was the Vikings in 2016 when Norv Turner was out. They just decided they had to scrap that, basically scrap anything downfield altogether and just go to all quick strike.
And that was not how Turner played. That's not what his system was built for, and he didn't feel that he was the best guy to run that, and that's why he left. And Pat Shurmur took over, and it kind of worked out well for everybody, and Turner's back in the NFL with Carolina now, and we know where Shurmur is. That Minnesota offensive line, they had a lot of injuries that year, too. It wasn't just losing the left tackle. They'd had three or four guys, I think, by that point go down, and multiple tackles. So even the backup tackles were out at by that stage of the season. And that's also what I would cite as the most glaring example of a tackle derailing your offense. If you get multiple injuries at one position in football, in almost any position, save for maybe safety, if you get more, and especially these reactionary positions, so cornerbacks who react to wide receivers, offensive tackles who react to pass rushers, if you get multiple injuries at those positions, that's a hard thing to overcome. That's the worst thing that can happen to you, because the difference between a third string and a second string guy is also huge, and the difference between second and first string at those positions, it's already huge. So you're really playing with a crippling deficiency if you have that. That's happened to a number of teams. Every year it happens to one or two teams. Their season gets ruined by three or four injuries that happen to be concentrated at the same position. Offensive tackle is a great example.
Yep. Well, you run out of next men after a while.
Yeah, the whole next man up. Well, what happens when you don't have a next man? If I was someone's next man up, that team's done. It's not just next man up. That gets so overblown. It matters who the man is.
Yes, absolutely. Another offensive tackle question here, or I should say offensive line. This is Mark via Talkback. I noticed this past season that the Steelers' offensive line employed a lot of upright two-point stances, even on running plays. This type of stance didn't seem to be overly noticeable when watching other offensive lines. Do you have any insight or theory as to why the Steelers have their linemen line up this way? Is it to keep defenses slightly on their toes during pre-snap reads, to gain downfield leverage? It ended there.
Ellipses. So we take it from here then.
Yes.
Some of those are probably draws and just or the run pass option type of plays, not necessarily that, but they're flexible plays, because the Steelers at their best running the ball, they're a gap scheme run team. Think of a fullback out there with David DeCastro pull blocking, and both of those guys, a fullback and DeCastro, work into the point of attack. They've had a lot of success with that in Pittsburgh, and I think it fits Le'Veon Bell's style. When you play that way, you're going to be in a three-point stand. You're not, I mean, almost every time. It's hard. Yeah. You're not going to line up in very many two-point stances. So I think some of it's just circumstantial, the reason those guys are lining up like that. If we wanted to get really creative, and this is probably a question we have for our friend Ross Tucker or Jeff Schwartz or someone, is would, because of Le'Veon Bell's unique style and the patience and how long it takes him to get from A to B by design, would you ever consider using a two-point stance instead of a three-point stance, and what would be the mechanical reasons behind that? And I don't know the answer to that. My inclination is to say, I think we're overthinking it, but it'd be a smart question to at least broach with someone who's done this.
Yeah. Next question. This is coming from Tommy via TalkBack. What if Jacoby Brissett were to be traded to the Ravens? And I'll preface this. I'll add this for Tommy. They can't. The Ravens can't bring another. Joe Flacco is their guy right now. They're paying him. I don't like saying this, but they're paying him too much. They can't cut him. They'd be taking on. It would be more expensive to cut him than to keep him at this point. So he's their guy for 2018, and they can discuss it next year. He'd still be very expensive to cut in 2019. They'd be paying a lot of money for a guy who's not on the roster. But yeah, Flacco's there now. So let's talk Brissett long term. Would he be a guy who maybe fits in Baltimore? Because it's a big year for Flacco. I mean, he has been down the last 2 years significantly, but then you saw a little bit late in the season, you sort of saw a little bit of what he used to be, and he looked pretty good in December.
Yeah, he looked okay. They asked different things of him. They finally tweaked the offense, and he was a complimentary piece rather than the guy running the whole show and working the ball downfield, which he hadn't been doing anyway. So they became a run-first offense, and I'm fine with that. If that's what you have to do to play with them and it works, that's fine. I've been a big Joe Flacco guy for a number of years. I'm not anymore, though. At some point, you have to look at all the evidence on film and say, yeah, you know what, the talent's there, the pedigree's there, that playoff run he had in 2012 might be the best I've ever seen. But he hasn't played well in 3 years or 2 years or two and a half or whatever. I mean, it's been a long time. And so I don't know what to do. If I had to pick between building around Flacco or Brissett for the next 3 to 4 years, I think I roll the dice with Brissett there. But I am not espousing the Ravens should do that, because there are other factors that you mentioned. And, yeah, they did kind of get on track a little bit later in the year with him. So when you add that in plus the money, I can see why you would continue to ride with Joe Flacco one more season. But I am very high on Jacoby Brissett, and I am not as high on Flacco as I used to be.
Yeah. Yeah, this really is the last year with Flacco that you say, well, we have to keep him. You know, you can start talking about moving on after this season. And as far as Brissett goes, he's still on that really cheap rookie deal through 2019. And if I'm the Colts, I probably like the fact that I have a really inexpensive and potentially very good backup quarterback on my roster.
Yeah, and let's remember, Andrew Luck is up in the air, too. Luck and Carson Wentz, their health is both up in the air, and they both happen to have unique and in Wentz's case, now a proven backup, and in Luck's case, a very intriguing backup behind him. That's unusual to see two high-level superstar QBs who have question marks about their health, and they happen to have quality backup solutions built in.
Yeah. I think we got time for one more question. We won't wrap it up quite yet. Last question, David via TalkBack. Andy, you asked a great question. Why didn't the Eagles bring out the Philly special on their two-point conversion attempt earlier in the game? Do you think Peterson would have even used the trick play on fourth and goal if the Patriots hadn't failed in the meantime on a weirdly similar play that Danny Amendola passed that bounced off Brady's fingertips? We know via Peter King that the Eagles had been practicing it in the hotel ballroom away from spying eyes, yet the timing of the play call seemed extracurricular. Coincidence? a jogging of the memory or one upsmanship due to that earlier Patriots play? I think that's an interesting theory. I don't know if we have a real good answer to that, but that's an interesting theory. Maybe that inspired them to bring it out after seeing the Patriots run a similar trick play.
Maybe on a subconscious level. There's no way, though, that Peterson looked out on the field and saw Tom Brady drop the ball and thought, oh, I'll show you how a quarterback catches. Here we go. I mean, that didn't happen. But maybe on a subconscious level, perhaps. I do wonder why they didn't run on the 2-point, but the answer to that would be, well, it wasn't something they'd planned going in. Doug Peterson, the more I learn about him, and I've never met him, and so I certainly don't know about the way his mind works, but I get the sense he's a roll with your gut, let's go with the flow, kind of make the decisions in the moment type of guy, versus, which is odd, because the guy he worked for, Andy Reid, is almost the counter opposite of that, totally different. He's a very much a preparation guy. And Peterson might, I bet they got there and Peterson thought, all right, 4th and 1, we're going for it. We've been doing that all year. We're going to take the chance. And, oh, what play do we want to call if we're going to do that? And I guess Nick Foles suggested, he called it Philly, but mm-hmm. Peterson knew what Foles meant, Philly special. He said, all right, yeah, let's do that one. I mean, that's how they said it went down. The Eagles have been pretty transparent about everything in the wake of their Super Bowl win. So I'll believe that story. I think he just called it on a whim.
Yeah, and by the way, my least favorite post Super Bowl story right now is the illegal formation story on that on that play. It
Wait,
this
like
is
Debbie Downer kind of thing, like you sourpuss about the
well,
the play,
I never like discussions like this, because what the conversation is, look, Alshon Jeffrey, the receiver, basically motions to the side judge saying, "Am I lined up okay?" And the side judge presumably said yes, otherwise it would be really weird if he said no and Jeffrey stayed there anyway.
I dare you to call it.
he has the go-ahead, and that's really the end of the discussion right there. So, you know, a lot of people are coming out like, well, it's still technically, the side judge shouldn't have given the go-ahead. And when you start having conversations like this, the headlines are all illegal formation. So now there's all these people, oh, they shouldn't have gotten that touchdown. That play was bogus and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's,
no, that's,
you know,
yeah.
Because you can't actually, and no one actually dives deep into the conversation. You know, you just see the headline and then you react and you get on Twitter and you put on all caps and that's how we live. But so yeah, I hate when stories like that start unfolding like this, because it is. It's just, you know, it's not a conversation that casual football fans have or understand. And, you know, when it comes right down to it, the whole reason receivers motion over to the side judge to make sure they're lined up okay is to avoid something like that. And that's what Jeffrey
right,
did.
And he got the
go-ahead. No, it's done.
You're right. I don't feel like this story has caught fire, though. I know it's been out there, and I've seen that, but I don't think it's ever swept up into much of a conversation except in some niche pockets.
Maybe it will now that we've talked about it.
Now that we did yeah, possibly.
Yes, but we've heard about it plenty at the MMQB between TalkBack and Twitter and Facebook and whatnot, but...
Well, let's remember, the people we hear, who was it, Ronald Reagan, that said the silent majority, they're fine with everything. It's the people you hear from aren't necessarily representative of what people think.
Yeah. Well, let's wrap it up with that. The words of Ronald Reagan.
I hope it was
seems
Ronald
as appropriate
Reagan
as any.
Yeah.
Free agent shows coming up. Please give a listen. Yeah, we're going to talk about quarterbacks next week. It will be the non-quarterbacks the week after that. It's going to be a wild free agent period here. So many quarterbacks out there. So many teams on the cusp of greatness if they find the right quarterback. So it's going to be a really interesting offseason here. But that'll do it for now. Thanks, as always, to producers Shelby Royson and Lou Pellegrino, as well as Chris Basil editing. Cadence 13, guys, so good at what they do. Always make it sound so good. But most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. You really are the best. Like we keep saying, we're going to have the mailbags frequently, the mini mailbags, like we just did, frequently during the offseason. If you want to send questions, talkback@themmqb.com. Just put podcast in the subject somewhere. You can get us on Twitter, Andy_Benoit, G_Graham. _SI, or we are both on Facebook. Even if you don't have a question, if you just want to drop a note, tell us what we can do better or what you like. That would be fine, too. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB Podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB Podcast with Peter King, and this podcast, the MMQB 10 Things Podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys next week for Free Agency. As regulation has officially expired on our podcast and there's no overtime in sight, I'll spare you the agony of more sports jokes. However, nothing hits the spot like some shut-eye after playing or attending a sporting event, and we think the same goes for listening to us talk about it. So let Mattress Firm help you drift off to dreamland. Simply put, your budget stretches further at Mattress Firm. Head to mattressfirm.com/podcast to learn how you can turn your sleep into a true slam dunk.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.